Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. I'm excited to have a repeat guest today. Dr. Stephanie Seneff has been on the show two times in the past, and it's been a couple of years since we last had her on. But she recently came out with a new book called Toxic Legacy, How the Weed Killer Glyphosate is Destroying Our Health and the Environment. And since we live in Roundup Ready cotton capital of the world, I believe, glyphosate, which is the primary ingredient in Roundup, as most of the listeners, I think, know by now, I thought this would be a great topic for us to talk about and to talk about Dr. Seneff's work in this new book. I encourage everybody to go pick up a copy and read it. Just real quick, for those who are new to the show and don't know of Dr. Stephanie Seneff's work, Dr. Seneff is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And since 2010, Dr. Seneff has research is focused on the effects of drugs, toxic chemicals, and diet on human health and disease. And she's written and spoken extensively articulating her views on these subjects. And we are very excited that she's here today to articulate her views. She's authored dozens of peer-reviewed journal articles over the years, chapters to various books. And now this book, again, Toxic Legacy is the name of it. Everybody go out and get a copy and read it. I highly recommend it. Just a couple of quotes from the back of the book. Some endorsements. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., quote, "Monsanto made a special project of discrediting and destroying scientists, advocates, and reformers who exposed its corrupt cover-up. Among the most prominent of these was heroic MIT researcher Dr. Stephanie Seneff." So that's a pretty awesome accolade, or depend on how you look at it. I don't know if that's good or bad, if you are the number one chief target. But Dr. Seneff, welcome to the show today. I appreciate you taking some time to be with us.
So great to be here. Thank you.
Well, and I want to remind the listeners again, of course, our longtime listeners understand what we believe here at Veritas Medical is God designed the body beautifully, and it will function like it's supposed to if you just steward it right, if you equip it. And it's pretty simple to do. You eat real food. You hydrate with clean mineralized water, you move around a little bit every day and get some sunshine outside, and most importantly, be at peace. Don't be in fight or flight mode all day long. The body's not designed to operate in stress mode, fight or flight mode all the time, and especially fear, which has overcome the entire world this past year and a half. It's all about the terrain. It's not about the germ. It's not about the gene even. Those are all secondary. I'm not saying they don't exist or aren't a part of the equation, but they're secondary to your terrain. It is clear in the medical literature that terrain trumps germs and terrain trumps genes. And when we say terrain, it's what we're talking about, these basic concepts of diet and lifestyle factors that have so dramatically changed over the past 100 years. We used to be healthy, Americans. We were the healthiest country of all the industrialized countries pre-World War II. We were the healthiest. Now we're the sickest. 80 years later, we have fallen to last place in just about every category. And you can point it all back to diet and lifestyle. The terrain, we've very much disrupted our terrain. One of the biggest terrain disruptors, and probably Dr. Seneff would say the number one biggest terrain disruptor, is glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup. And so this is a exceedingly important topic. I know everyone's talking about COVID and the vaccine and all that, and we'll get into that too, because Dr. Seneff just wrote recently published a paper about that, and we can't help but talk about that also. But I just want to remind everyone, this is really so, every health topic you want to talk about will be intricately related to your terrain and how well have you stewarded your terrain. And the better you steward your terrain, the less you have to worry about, for sure, ever needing a vaccine, but the less you have to worry about any disease or any germ. So let's dive right in, Dr. Seneff. First, if you don't mind, just a little brief intro for our new listeners in particular on how you get from studying electrical engineering and computer science and artificial intelligence into glyphosate and all the things that the glyphosate research has led you to. Just give us a brief overview of how you've gotten to where you are today.
Right. Yes, it's quite a change in my career, because for many years I was writing code that was developing systems that would allow computers to communicate with humans using natural speech, precursors to Amazon Echo and the iPhone Siri. So nice to see that technology come to life and become, you know, a commodity. But about 2006, 2007 timeframe, I started watching the data on autism rates going up in this country year by year. And I was very worried about that, because I saw that if those trends continued, we would have half the kids with autism in the not too distant future. So we needed to figure out what was causing the autism to go up. And I was frustrated that they were using most of the research dollars to study genetics. And certainly there's a genetic component to autism, but that's not the reason for the epidemic. It had to be something in the environment. And I started systematically looking at different things, you know, like, of course, the vaccines, which I do think are a factor, you know, lead and fluoride and all these other chemicals, the plastics. There's so many things that our kids are exposed to. It's part of the reason why it makes it hard to figure it out. But I was studying the symptoms of autism, and I was seeing these kids often had major gut problems. So I was suspecting something they were eating or something they were getting in through their digestive system was disrupting it. And I thought perhaps antibiotics, because they were getting ear infections. And then the question was, why were they getting so many ear infections? So I was kind of lost. I mean, it was at a point where I could see the rates were going up. It was a very complex disease. And I hadn't found anything that would be the target exposure that I was looking for that was also going up in step with the rise in glyphosate. I mean, rise in autism. And I happened to be at a conference in around 2012. So I had been looking for 5 years, and I was at a conference. Professor Don Huber gave a 2-hour presentation on glyphosate. And at that time, I didn't know what glyphosate was, but I certainly knew about Roundup, and I'd never used it because I don't like to use toxic chemicals on my lawn or anywhere in my home. And but he started talking about glyphosate and how it was disrupting the soil bacteria and then disrupting the gut bacteria, chelating minerals, making them unavailable, messing up the liver, causing other toxic chemicals to be much more toxic than they would otherwise be, disrupting sulfur supplies. These were all things that made a lot of sense to me in the context of what I knew about autism. So then I really walked away from that presentation convinced that I needed to look a lot harder at glyphosate as possibly being the chemical, the one that stands out, that is the most the biggest reason why we have an autism epidemic. I will go out on a limb and say that I believe glyphosate is the biggest factor in our increase in autism that we're seeing. And it keeps on going up ever since then. It's kept on going up. Very frightening numbers. The youngest ones are now, you know, aging out of the childhood system, and we don't have any place to put them. We're not used to having adult autism, and it's going to be growing phenomenally in the next few years. So we've got a huge problem with all these disabled kids, and then as they age out of the system, and as their parents age and die, then they're going to be left stranded. It's really just horrible to think about all of this, and it really keeps me awake at night.
Well, and it does me too. When I was born in the early 70s, statistics were about 1 in 10,000 kids had autism, and the latest stats, depending on where you look, are somewhere, I believe, around 1 in 36, 1 in 40, something like that.
And yes, certainly in some states, yeah.
Yeah, and you can't, I don't believe you can just blame that on better diagnostics, because as you said, we haven't seen the adult population of autism as we're seeing now. You don't really miss that diagnosis. So from there, explain, if you don't mind, to the listeners, kind of the impacts. What's the connection? What do you feel like is the biggest detrimental factor between glyphosate and autism and health in general? Is it the effect on the microbiome, the chelation of the minerals, or what exactly is it doing that could set the body up for this, for autism and other things?
Yeah, it's actually many things, and it's amazing how many things that you can find that glyphosate disrupts, and all of them are seen in autism. So it's quite remarkable, and it really starts, I think, with the gut microbiome. Glyphosate disrupts an enzyme, a critical enzyme in the plant called EPSP synthase. It's an enzyme in a pathway, a critical pathway called the shikimate pathway. All plants have this pathway in it, and they can't live if it's broken. So that's why it kills all plants. And but it also turns out many microbes also have this pathway. In fact, a study said that 54% of the species in our gut have this pathway, have a version of this enzyme that would be badly affected by glyphosate. So the gut, and it's particularly it's the beneficial microbes that are more sensitive than the pathogen. So what's happening is that lactobacillus and bifidobacteria are getting clobbered by the glyphosate that's in our food, and it's all over the food supply. That's another thing that people aren't aware of. You know, the government doesn't even bother to test, but various activists have been testing foods and finding high levels in foods that are very popular with children, like Goldfish crackers and Oreo cookies, Cheerios. You know, these are very foods that lots of kids eat, and they have high levels of glyphosate in them. So the kids are being, and of course the mother's being disrupted too. So in utero, the child is affected. And so the gut microbiome gets disturbed, and then you get pathogens, and then you get the immune cells coming in, and inflammation starts happening, and then you start destroying the gut lining. You get a leaky gut situation. On top of that, it disrupts the digestion of proteins. So you have proteins like gluten. You know, people have an epidemic now in gluten intolerance. Casein intolerance, which is a protein in milk, so wheat and milk. So a lot of people have found that with autistic kids, if they go dairy-free and wheat-free, gluten-free, their symptoms improve. And that's really because those proteins are difficult to digest to begin with, and the microbes, in particular lactobacillus, helps us out with the digestion of those proteins. They have specialized enzymes that we don't have that help to break down those proteins. So when the lactobacillus is getting clobbered, the gluten is not getting digested, and then you have these peptides hanging around in the gut and irritating the gut, and then that causes the inflammation. And then the leaky gut, the peptides get out into circulation, and then the immune cells get upset with that because they see these foreign proteins. Then you get autoimmune disease because the foreign proteins have sequences that are similar to sequences in human proteins that are associated with autoimmune disease. So you get a lot of nasty symptoms as a consequence of this cascade that happens because your digestive system is screwed up.
Right, and to the tune of 54% of kids now have some sort of chronic medical condition. Many of these are behavioral disorders and autoimmune type conditions of inflammatory nature, like asthma and eczema, and of course all the different food sensitivities that used to be unheard of. So there's a huge correlation, and I've seen the graphs where you can just overlay the pounds per acre or however it's measured of glyphosate usage over the last couple decades or three decades or so. You overlay that with the incidence of these various diseases, and it's a remarkable correlation. Correlation, we talk about, doesn't equal causation, but it should equal we need to investigate a whole lot more, and that's where you come in, I think. All the investigation and connecting these dots. And I think the last time we talked, you were just starting to really look at phosphate and glycine and some of that. So could you speak to that piece of the puzzle that I think our listeners haven't heard yet?
That is a very interesting piece of the puzzle, and it's the focus of my book, because I really wanted people to understand why I believe, and the evidence that's there to show that glyphosate is disrupting proteins by getting into the proteins themselves by in place of the coding amino acid glycine. So proteins are they're the building blocks of the body. They do everything, really. They're so important in our function, and that's what the DNA code is all about. The code has a sequence that codes for the protein of nucleotides, and then the sequence gets translated into proteins, and they're assembled like beads on a string. And so each bead is an amino acid, and glycine is one of the 20 or so coding amino acids that go into these proteins. So when you have glyphosate sitting around, it is a complete glycine molecule, except that it has extra material stuck onto its nitrogen atom. So I think what's happening is the machinery gets confused. It picks up the glyphosate by mistake and sticks it into the protein where it should have put a glycine. And this causes the protein not to behave correctly. And certain proteins are especially sensitive to displacement of certain glycines in them with glyphosate. And you can predict what would happen by studying the research literature. And what I found is a giant puzzle, but you can find specific proteins that are implicated as part of the disease process. When they're broken, they cause certain diseases, and those proteins have certain glycines in them that are very susceptible to glyphosate substitution. So it's a giant puzzle, and it's a lot of fun to read the research literature and hunt down the proteins. People have genetic mutations in a certain glycine, for example, in collagen, and you can get, you know, serious diseases because of that. And so so you can look for the genetic mutations, and then you can predict if glyphosate were to substitute, it would have a similar effect. Not as dramatic, because it wouldn't be all the instances of that protein, but it would mess up that protein. And so, for example, myosin. Myosin is a muscle contractile protein, very important in the gut for digestion. Myosin has like 11 highly conserved, which means very important glycines in it. And there was a paper that talked about just one. And that one glycine, if you replace it with alanine, which is a very small change, just an extra methyl group, the protein can only contract at 1% of its capacity. So, you know, and then glyphosate's been shown to paralyze the gut. When a woman tried to kill herself by drinking glyphosate, and it paralyzed her gut. So this is making sense to me that many of these autistic kids have problems with peristalsis. They can't push the food through the gut, so it backs up, and it gets backed up, and then you get SIBO, you know, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Because the foods are not moving sufficiently well through the gut, they get constipated, and then they get bloated, and then they get diarrhea. You know, it's the gut is not working properly at all. And part of that is this disrupted microbiome with all this inflammatory response. Part of it is also, I think, because the contraction's not working properly.
Yeah. And the next step in that sequence after the peristalsis and the disruption of the microbiome, the bloating, gas, constipation, all that, and then the next step is they get diagnosed with IBS, which is just a term that just describes all those symptoms. It doesn't tell you, it doesn't get to the root of what's really causing it, which is what I love about your work, trying to get to the root cause. And this reminds me of the quote from the book. This is the beginning of chapter 10 on autoimmunity. And it's a quote from William Parker, PhD, Duke University School of Medicine. Quote, "Modern medicine asks what and how. What conditions do you have? How do we treat them? But we should be asking why. This is the first critical step towards prevention. If we don't know why something happens, we can't hope to stop it." And I mean, what you just laid out there is a perfect example of that. I have so many young people come to our clinic. Just had one yesterday. They've been to the gastroenterologist, the pediatric gastroenterologist, the specialist at the medical school, and they know what is happening. They're bloated and they're constipated and they're in pain and they've been diagnosed with IBS. Some even get diagnosed with SIBO, but sometimes it's all the way to ulcerative colitis or something more inflammatory. But we just aren't trained in conventional medicine to drill down deeper into the why. And like I said at the top of the show, almost always the why is going to land you back somewhere in your diet and your lifestyle. And the fact that we've traded cost and convenience in so many areas of our life, including agricultural food production and stuff like glyphosate. So I just want to close that loop and make that connection for people that this really matters to your health and what we're talking about here. Dr. Sinov, could you speak to the phosphate, chapter 5, the phosphate puzzle? Can you explain a little more about phosphate and how it fits
this picture? Yeah, that's so fascinating because it's not just that it substitutes for glycine in the proteins, but it substitutes for glycine specifically and most vulnerably in a whole bunch of proteins that are involved with binding to some molecule containing phosphate. And the reason why it does that is because glyphosate's extra piece that's on the nitrogen atom is a methylphosphonate unit, and it looks a whole lot like phosphate. It fits into a spot where phosphate should go. And so the proteins that need to bind to phosphate have designed themselves so that they have room for that phosphate in the substrate. It's going to be a separate molecule, such as phosphoenolpyruvate. That's, in fact, phosphoenolpyruvate is the molecule that EPSP synthase binds to, and it's the place where it binds that molecule, PEP, is where glyphosate disrupts it. And they found that if you take the glycine that's at that spot and replace it with alanine, again, that's the smallest change you can make. If you do that, then that version of the protein becomes completely insensitive to glyphosate. This was something that, you know, Monsanto folks figured out. And what makes sense is that it's actually substituting for the glycine in the protein itself, occupying the space where the phosphate is supposed to go and shutting the phosphate out. And once you do that, then the enzyme can't perform its operation and can't do the enzyme. activity that needs to get done in order to make the product, which is this, you know, in the shikimate pathway, the products of that enzyme end up being essential amino acids. So the products of that enzyme are also really, really important to biology. Our cells can't make it because they don't have that enzyme. They don't have that pathway. And we depend upon our gut microbes to supply these important nutrients to us that they can't supply because glyphosate's blocking that enzyme by substituting for the glycine that's at the place where the enzyme binds to the phosphate in PEP. A little bit of complicated biology there. Once you know that, then you can start looking for human enzymes that have similar properties. And one that you will find is PEP carboxykinase, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. That's a human enzyme that's super important in the liver and that also binds the phosphate of PEP at a site where glycine is highly conserved. So exactly the same model as what goes on with the enzyme that glyphosate famously disrupts. You can predict that it would also disrupt this other enzyme in the liver. And that is super, super critical for the liver's function, and in particular for something called gluconeogenesis, which is you're able to get sugar, other things like milk, you know, lactose in milk, things like other fats, they can be converted into sugar through this enzyme PEPCK. And when that can't happen, you get into a lot of trouble with the potential for getting very low blood sugar. And that can cause you to go into a coma. So I think that's actually contributing to the sudden infant death syndrome that we're seeing in kids today. Young kids are getting dying because of low blood glucose because that enzyme is broken by glyphosate. And that also causes the set point for sugar to go up in the blood because the body becomes aware there's a risk of going into a coma if sugar gets too low. So it ends up keeping the sugar levels high in the blood all the time to protect from that. If you were to do a lot of exercise and not get a chance to eat, your sugar could get so low you could go into a coma. So that becomes a threat. And the body readjusts the set point, which ends up having high blood glucose, high sugar in your blood, which is a precursor to diabetes. So that's what takes you down that path towards type 2 diabetes because of the disruption of this enzyme. And that also can explain fatty liver disease, which is something we see is very highly correlated with glyphosate. There was a study on rats that showed low exposure, below regulatory limits, exposure to glyphosate for these rats caused them to develop fatty liver disease. And we have an epidemic in humans in fatty liver disease that corresponds with the rise in use of glyphosate. And a study on humans showed that people with fatty liver disease had higher levels of glyphosate in their urine on average, statistically significantly higher levels. And those with worse disease had statistically significant higher levels of glyphosate than those with a lesser form of the disease. So three different groups of people, the unaffected, the lesser affected, and the highly affected, all of them had statistically significant different amounts of glyphosate in their urine.
Well, that was, for the listeners, I know that was a lot of biochemistry there. And I just want to sort of summarize that by saying, these amino acids, think of them as, you know, letters in the alphabet. There's about 20 amino acids in the body that you stack them up in certain sequences to make these proteins that do things for us. These enzymes in the body, there's 9,000 plus enzymes. And just remember, the enzymes are the workers in the body. That's how things get done. We always talk about the sunshine hitting the skin, and then this cholesterol in your skin gets converted into vitamin D. Well, that doesn't just happen, you know, out of thin air, presto. There's enzymes that are doing work, that are cleaving off certain molecules or adding other molecules on. They're actually the workers that are moving things around and sticking things on and taking things off to change things and make the body work. And there's thousands and thousands of these enzymes. And you take just one letter out of the alphabet, one of these amino acids, glycine, out, and you see this devastating cascade, or like with the phosphate. I mean, the body's so intricately designed in this perfect balance of things, and the microbes in the gut that contribute to the whole process. It's just this amazing symphony, and it will perform like it's supposed to. Again, like I said at the top of the show, it's so cool that there are some very intelligent scientists that can figure a lot of this out, like Dr. Seneff. But ultimately, we can just trust that the body's going to do what it's supposed to do. It will heal itself. It will maintain homeostasis, maintain a normal state of function. If it has all the amino acids it needs and it has all the enzymes functioning like they're supposed to, it has all the minerals it's supposed to have, phosphorus and all the other minerals we talk about. So just be encouraged, listeners, although this is complicated, the point that I'm trying to drive home is the beauty of it. If we will just make the effort to give the body what it needs and avoid what it doesn't. And one of the big things it doesn't need is glyphosate, which is Roundup. So back to the book, though, Dr. Seneff. Chapter 6, sulfate. And we've talked about sulfate on previous shows with you, but just kind of bring people back up to speed. The title of the chapter 6, Sulfate Miracle Worker. What gives sulfate, what elevates sulfate to the title of miracle worker? What is it doing in the body?
Yeah, it's quite interesting and quite, of course, biology is always quite complicated, but sulfate is very, very important in part for the health of the blood. And that includes both the lining of the blood, you know, and also the actual red blood cells. The red blood cells have cholesterol sulfate in their membrane, and that provides them with a negative charge. And not only does that keep the red blood cells separated from each other because they repel each other when they're both negatively charged, but also that negative charge helps to propel them through the capillary because there's a voltage drop from the artery to the vein. So there's a force that, just like a magnet, there's a force that pulls the red blood cells through the capillary. If they have less negative charge, they have a weaker tug, a weaker force, so it's harder for them to get through. The other thing is the sulfates line the vesicle wall, so that the capillary wall has sulfates stuck into it all over the place, and those sulfates have a special effect on water. They make gelled water, and so you end up with a gel, like jello, surrounding all along the surface of the blood vessel. There's jello, and then there's a very slick boundary. You know, sort of like, if you think of the surface of a bowl of jello, it's very slick and smooth, and so the red blood cells can slide through the capillaries, because capillaries just barely, red blood cells barely fit. The capillaries are very small. So if they don't have this sort of smooth wall surface in front of them, they'll have a hard time getting through the capillary. There'll be a lot of resistance. So you end up with, you know, high resistance, high blood pressure. And of course, that's a precursor to all kinds of diseases like heart disease and stroke. And so you're basically, your circulation gets messed up badly when there isn't enough sulfate in the body.
And what is the glyphosate doing to the sulfate? Is there a direct chelation, or is it binding it up somehow?
It messes up sulfate just about every way you can think of, and starting with sulfur uptake in the plants. And that's one of the things Don Huber talked about. He showed that that glyphosate disrupted the ability of the plants to take up sulfur from the soil. So they ended up severely sulfur deficient as a consequence of glyphosate exposure. So our food is depleted in sulfur, and we never, you know, sulfur doesn't even have a minimum daily requirement. That the medical system seems to be unaware that there could be an issue with actual sulfur deficiency. But the other thing is, you need not just sulfur, but sulfate. And sulfate is sulfur plus four oxygen atoms plus a negative two charge. And making the sulfate is tricky, and moving it around is tricky, and transferring it from one molecule to another is tricky. All of those things require skill, and the body has developed very sophisticated mechanisms for performing all of these steps. One thing that the body has learned is that you have to attach a sulfate to a carrier molecule in order to transport it in the blood, because sulfate will gel the blood. Because it gels water, you don't want to have the whole... You want to keep the blood flowing, so you cannot afford to have too much sulfate in the blood standing alone. So you buddy it up with other molecules like cholesterol. So you have cholesterol sulfate, which is flowing through the blood, transporting. That's a way to successfully transport both the cholesterol and the sulfate. They buddy up to help each other out, because the cholesterol by itself is not water soluble. So this is a technique the body has discovered to be able to move around the cholesterol and get it to where it needs to go. Cholesterol is a very essential molecule on its own, and also to transport the sulfate. So once the cholesterol sulfate arrives at a destination, the sulfate has to be taken off, and then it gets put into the extracellular matrix area of that cell. And then the cholesterol gets taken up, and both of them are vital nutrients for the cell. But they were traveling together, paired up. And glyphosate disrupts the ability to make the sulfate. It disrupts the ability to activate the sulfate. It needs to be converted into an active form of sulfate. That enzyme is probably disrupted by glyphosate due to glycine sensitivities. It disrupts the transfer, the hooking of the sulfate onto the second molecule, and therefore it disrupts the circulation, the supply line for the sulfate. So when all those sulfate problems come up, the body is stuck with a very serious difficulty of trying to figure out how to get the sulfate to where it needs to go and keep the blood healthy.
So would that be a potential reason for elevated cholesterol? If there's excess sulfate in the blood, would the body try to deal with that by elevating the cholesterol production?
Can you say that again? I didn't quite catch that.
If there's excess sulfate in the blood, would the body in turn increase the production of cholesterol to deal with that?
Right. So I think there's cholesterol is not the only one. There's many different interesting molecules in the body that are sulfated in transit. One of them is vitamin D. So vitamin D and cholesterol and also molecules that come out of that shikimate pathway, the pathway that glyphosate famously disrupts, produces these aromatic amino acids, tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine.
Okay, everybody. Well, we've been listening to Dr. Stephanie Seneff in her new book, Toxic Legacy, How the Weed Killer Glyphosate is Destroying Our Health and the Environment. When we come back from the break, we will talk more about what do we do about this and is there a way to get it out of us? How do we recover our minerals in our microbiome? We'll talk about vitamin D. And then we'll also get into this COVID shot. Some people call it a vaccine. Others say it doesn't meet the legal definition of vaccine, so they're not going to call it that. But Dr. Seneff has written a paper about that and some potential unintended consequences of this vaccine. So y'all stick with us. We will be right back. I'm Ben Edwards. You're The Cure. Okay, everybody, I'm back. We were with Dr. Stephanie Seneff, MIT research scientist, author of the book Toxic Legacy. Dr. Seneff, where's the best place for people to find you, find the book, follow your work?
I have a webpage called stephanieseneff.net that if you can remember my name, you can find me there. And it has also a separate section there under the book where you can see links to various booksellers that are selling my book. And of course, Amazon is selling it, but also many other booksellers, including the UK and others in the United States.
Okay. Awesome. Well, y'all check that out, stephanieseneff.net. I want to touch on vitamin D. We were just kind of getting to that before the break. And the fact that the vitamin D found in the body is sulfated, the difference between that and just taking a vitamin D pill or supplement from the store versus getting it in a food form, say like cod liver oil versus the sunlight-induced production of vitamin D in the body. Can you touch on the importance of natural vitamin D versus a synthetic or supplemental vitamin D, why people would need to try to get the real thing?
Yes. So it's actually, in my opinion, when you get sunlight exposure, you're not just getting vitamin D. And in fact, I often say, you know, to someone, I'll say, I'm a real fan of the sunlight, really believe in sun exposure. And they'll say, oh, yeah, I know vitamin D is really important. So they assume I mean vitamin D when I say sun exposure. And one thing I want to make clear to people is that sun exposure is not just about vitamin D. The sunlight performs other kinds of magic that vitamin D supplements miss. And in particular, of course, it catalyzes the synthesis of cholesterol sulfate. So both cholesterol sulfate and vitamin D sulfate are synthesized in the skin in response to the sunlight working as a catalyst. And also in the eyes, it's important to not wear sunglasses because you can get sunlight exposure to the pineal gland behind the eyes that allows it to make sulfate, and it uses that sulfate at night. It hooks it up to melatonin, and it ships melatonin sulfate into the brain ventricles, the cerebral spinal fluid, and delivers that melatonin sulfate to the neurons, which helps them to clear the garbage, which is what's important to do while you're sleeping. So it's really, sunlight is way more than vitamin D. I have actually never taken a vitamin D supplement, even though I'm a great fan of vitamin D, and I believe you need it, but you need to get it naturally. So from the sun. I don't mind getting it from naturally containing foods that have vitamin D because they're going to also have cholesterol sulfate. So it's going to be more of a, when you take vitamin D as a supplement, you're taking pure vitamin D, no sulfate and no cholesterol. Whereas if you take it as a natural component of a food, such as an organic egg or seafood, you know, salmon, or of course, seal blubber, you know, is one of the highest, seal blubber is something that the Eskimos were eating, which is helping them to get vitamin D because they don't have a lot of sunlight up there. So you can get it from foods, but I far prefer it from naturally from foods. There's certain foods that are supplemented, and I don't like that. So I don't agree with the idea of just, in fact, milk would be a great source of vitamin D, but they destroy it. When they process the milk, they destroy it, and then they put it back in as a synthetic. So, of course, there's this distinction between D3 and D2 as well, and D2 comes from vegetables, and D3 comes from, is an animal-based source. And D3 does a lot more than D2 does as far as maintaining your health. So vitamin D is really important for your immune system, which means that it's extremely important to get a lot of sunlight these days when you're facing a potential infection with COVID-19. I think it's been shown in studies that many of the people who die of COVID-19, most of them have vitamin D deficiency as part of their profile. And I think that's really critical to get the vitamin D up high to protect from COVID and to do so by getting out in the sunlight.
Right. Well, I'm 100% in agreement. I don't take vitamin D supplements. I get it from sun. I get it from food sources. What do you say to folks that are scared of the sun and that use sunscreen? I know you cover this in your book some on how to do a healthy reboot, but speak to that a little bit. I mean, sunscreen is just so readily applied these days, especially with kids.
It's really sad to me that the dermatologists have become so fanatical about making sure that you douse yourself in sunscreen whenever you go outside. I think it's a huge mistake. In fact, if you would just, you know, gradually develop a tan in the spring when the sun is not so harsh, the tan offers much better protection in the summer sun. Your tan is a natural sunscreen, but it's so much healthier than the stuff you put on your skin. A lot of these sunscreens have aluminum in them, and aluminum actually disrupts the enzyme in the skin that makes the cholesterol sulfate and the vitamin D sulfate. So you can really work against it. Of course, the sunscreen also blocks the rays that trigger the production of vitamin D. So you're really hurting yourself with respect to natural things that should be happening that are getting disrupted, and toxic chemicals in the sunscreen itself that are being absorbed. And in fact, the rate of skin melanoma is going up over time as the use of sunscreen is going up in parallel. So there's a very strong correlation between the rise in sunscreen use and the rise in skin melanoma, which is just crazy because the sunscreen is supposed to be, that's the thing it's supposed to be doing, it's protecting you from melanoma.
Well, a two-part question here. I think we've laid out a pretty good case for glyphosate is not beneficial for the body. Like I said earlier, we live in the middle of Roundup Ready cotton, capital of the world. So the exposures here, even if you're trying to not eat it, which obviously that's the number one thing, eat organic. Don't purposely consume food that's doused in glyphosate, which is going to be most foods on the grocery store shelf, unfortunately. If you're a farmer, don't use it. Go organic. And that can be done. I will be interviewing a farmer soon who's doing that here locally and very successfully. I know there's probably a cloud of glyphosate over the entire county. But what are some things that people can do from a mitigation standpoint, or even from a detoxification standpoint? Is there anything that can gobble up this glyphosate or Roundup and neutralize it or get it out of us versus just avoidance?
Yes, I know that's a really serious problem, and it's hard to get it out of your body once it's in. That's one of the really unfortunate things, I think, about the fact that it accumulates in the protein. So it gets into the proteins throughout your body, and at that point, it becomes very difficult to get it out. People have offered some products that claim to help to bind to the glyphosate and take it out through the feces. There's a Ion Biome is a product that's being promoted, and I've heard good things about it. People who are taking it are feeling that it's helping them heal. And probiotics is also a good possibility. Of course, to try to fix your gut microbes, you could eat probiotic foods such as sauerkraut and apple cider vinegar. I actually try to get apple cider vinegar every day. We make our own salad dressing, have a salad every night. So it's good to eat, you know, fresh vegetables. And the apple cider vinegar and the sauerkraut have a Acetobacter as one of the common microbes in there. And Acetobacter are among the few species that can fully metabolize glyphosate. So it's possible, and it hasn't been proven, but I've been claiming that it's possible that by taking apple cider vinegar or sauerkraut, and probably some other probiotics as well, certainly like kimchi and kombucha, you can provide yourself with microbes that can break down the glyphosate. So that's really a great way to do it. Sunlight can also break it down, and ozone and chlorine dioxide. So these are all you know, people have used therapies involving ozone and hydrogen peroxide and chlorine dioxide. Those are reactive oxygen molecules that can break down glyphosate.
Well, that's exciting, and we use many of those here in our clinic. And I want to encourage the listeners, too. We've tested people's urine who came in initially just standard American diet, standard American living, with high glyphosate levels. And just by being very cognizant of where their food's coming from and making some better food choices and trying to eat mostly organic, we've seen those levels drop dramatically in the urine. Now, of course, it can still be in the body and the proteins, as Dr. Seneff said, but you can make some significant headway just by making those switches on your grocery shopping. And if you're very limited on the budget, at the very minimum, do the Clean 15 Dirty Dozen. That's the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org. And you can look at that list that they put out every year. And at least if you have to save money somewhere, you can buy non-organic off the Clean 15, but definitely buy organic on the Dirty Dozen, which will be the foods that have the most glyphosate. They test those every year, so check that out too if you need some help on the budget side of things. Dr. Seneff, any final comments on the glyphosate in the book before we shift? Because I have to get some thoughts from you on COVID vaccine in the paper that you wrote, but also want to give you a chance to wrap up any other parts on the book that we didn't cover.
Yes, I mean, I just want to encourage people to think in terms of buying certified organic food as much as possible when they shop at the grocery store, and also whole foods to avoid the processed foods and to go for whole foods. And I think that's a very simple formula for how to stay healthy. Get outside in the sunlight, whole foods, and certified organic. And also, one thing I recommend as a supplement is Epsom salt baths. Just throwing a few Epsom salts into the bath water, have a hot bath and soak for a bit. Epsom salts are magnesium sulfate, so that's a very natural way to get sulfate gets absorbed through the skin. That's a good way to get sulfate supplied, especially if you have sulfur sensitivities, because many people do. They can't eat sulfur-containing foods, and I think that's a consequence of glyphosate exposure.
Right. And I concur. Highly recommend Epsom salt baths. Love the magnesium and the sulfur both. Thank you for that. So, looks like May 10th, 2021, a couple of months ago, in the International Journal of Vaccine Theory, Practice, and Research, this article came out. The title of the article, Worse Than the Disease? Reviewing some possible unintended consequences of the mRNA vaccines against COVID-19. We've got probably 15, 20 minutes left in the interview, so I want to give you plenty of time, or the remaining time, to discuss this. And first, I guess I would start with what made you decide to shift and kind of look at this vaccine. I know you've looked at vaccines as far as autism in the past, but is there a glyphosate connection with COVID-19 and or the vaccine?
Yes, I do think there's a glyphosate connection to COVID-19. It looks to me like there's a very strong pattern worldwide that the countries that are having trouble controlling COVID-19 are the same countries that are heavily using glyphosate in agriculture. And even the places where the new strains are coming out, you know, these dangerous new strains are coming out from countries that heavily use glyphosate. And I think I have a whole chapter in the book on glyphosate and the immune system, and I show how it disrupts the innate immunity And this is what you need. You need a strong innate immune system to fight off the virus. And when your innate immune system is weak, the virus takes hold in the lungs and multiplies furiously. And then you get this infiltration of these immune cells and this cytokine storm, you know, just an extreme immune reaction. So it's the overreactive immune system that's what's killing you, not the virus. But it's reacting so dramatically because of your inability to trap and clear the viruses. And I talk specifically about how glyphosate disrupts those abilities, having to do with glycine substitution in certain proteins. So that's a quite fascinating story by itself. So basically, you know, stay away from glyphosate to help yourself if you should catch COVID, to be able to heal quickly and not get terribly sick. If you can keep your glyphosate levels low, it's a very important thing to do to help protect you from COVID. The vaccines, I was really worried about the vaccines from the first time that I started hearing about them when they were, you know, starting up with this, launching this massive campaign to rush these vaccines to market, and skipping a number of steps in the protocol to confirm that they're safe. And particular long-term safety is something we haven't looked at all. And I'm very concerned about that. But we're seeing also plenty of evidence that these injections are far, far more powerful than the other vaccines that we've gotten used to. You know, the children are already getting way too many vaccines, in my opinion. But if you add this one, I'm really worried that they're going to decide that it's safe to give this to a six-month-old child. And they're going to start putting it on the requirements, you know, for the childhood vaccines every year. I just am terrified to think of that. I think that's going to be a direct path to an even more accelerated rate of autism increase. And I think these vaccines are going to, we're going to find that autoimmune disease and neurodegenerative diseases and various blood disorders are all going to start going up dramatically over time, as more and more people are subjected to this injection. It is a very, very toxic combination of things that they've put into those injections that make them extremely unsafe, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I do want to clarify on the word vaccine. There's a legal definition for that and a CDC FDA definition for that, which is a product that infers immunity and also keeps you from transmitting. And so this COVID-19 vaccine doesn't meet that definition. In fact, David Martin recently, I heard him in an interview talking about how, I believe it was Anthony Fauci, previously, years ago, was submitting for a patent for an mRNA vaccine, and the patent office had to decline because it didn't meet the definition of vaccine. So I found that very interesting. So this is a biological agent, the mRNA that is delivered to the body to tell the body to make a spike protein. So Dr. Senef, in your opinion, with this mRNA being introduced and the body taking that and starting to produce a spike protein, can you speak to the spike protein itself, the toxicity of that, and what's your understanding as far as the ability of this? Does mRNA get broken down? Does it get incorporated in? Does it stay around long term? Is the spike protein continually produced, you know, for months and months and months? What do we know about that right now?
Yes, I think it's extremely concerning. So basically, they've really manipulated what they're producing is something extremely not natural. And what they've done is they've taken the exact RNA sequence of the code for the spike protein, and they've created a version of RNA that's not normal. They actually manipulated one of the nucleotides. Every place that it occurs in the vaccine is a modified pseudomethyl, methyl pseudouridine instead of uridine for all of those nucleotides, which makes the RNA sturdy. It makes it harder to break it down. They also throw in this polyethylene glycol, which is a complicated molecule that gums, you know, sort of gloms together with the RNA and helps to keep it safe. Because normally, if you injected RNA into the body, it would disintegrate right away because we have enzymes ready to go to break it down. So what they have to do is they have to design it very specially to keep it very sturdy. And then they've also manipulated the actual code to make it better able to make protein. So they're doing everything. Their goal is to get it to be taken up by the cell, and they can do that by making it look like an LDL particle. They basically have a little particle with a lipid membrane However, they make the lipid a cationic lipid, positively charged, which is very, very irritating to the cell. So that cationic lipid in the membrane, which is a non-natural lipid, it's a fat, but it's a synthetic fat in the membrane, that irritates the cell. So you inject it into the muscle cells end up taking it up as if it's an LDL particle, only it's positively charged. This gets them very upset, and they call in the immune cells to come in and help them out. They recognize this thing is very dangerous. And when it comes inside, it naturally opens up, and the RNA is released, and it's been set up to be ready to go to make proteins, as if it's a human RNA molecule ready to produce protein. And there's no way for the cell to stop it from doing that. So the cell starts making all these spike proteins according to that RNA code that it can't break down. It can't break down that RNA molecule because it's so weird. It's not normal. And so the cell is overwhelmed with all the spike protein that it's making. Spike is extremely toxic, the most toxic part of the virus. And so the cell is ringing alarm bells. The immune cells come in. The immune cells then start taking up these particles as well. They don't know better. They can't help themselves. And they start making this spike protein. They start getting really sick. They are in a panic mode. They go into the lymph system. And they go into the lymph node underneath the arm. And they cause swelling of that lymph node, which is a characteristic feature of breast cancer. So we're getting women showing up thinking they might have breast cancer, and it's swollen only because of the vaccine, which doesn't mean to me that the vaccine might not be causing an increased risk to breast cancer. I would imagine that's an indicator that that's a possibility. It goes from the lymph nodes into the spleen, and that's where really a lot of the action takes place. And it's been shown that they've traced the RNA, and they show that that the spleen is the organ that gets the highest concentration of this RNA being transported in there by these immune cells. And this is their goal. So they're very happy that it's going into the spleen because there are germinal centers in the spleen which specialize in this whole process of exposing. So these innate immune cells, these like dendritic cells, go into the spleen, they pick up this RNA, they start making spike protein, and they push it out to the surface and they expose it on their surface. And this then causes B cells and T cells that are hanging out in the spleen to react and to then start perfecting their antibodies. So the whole point is to get these extremely refined, well-designed antibodies that exactly match the spike protein. And it succeeds spectacularly at its job. This is one thing I will say. They're very proud of it. 10 times as many antibodies as you would get just from the infection. Phenomenally successful. Their goal was to get it the body to make antibodies to the spike protein, and they have succeeded very, very well. And so, you know, this is making everybody happy because those antibodies would help you to clear the virus and make the disease milder. That's their goal, and I would say that they've succeeded in that goal. The trouble is that you are paying a big price when you force the immune system to get to that point where it's making these antibodies to the spike protein. Of course, you're releasing the spike protein as well. These immune cells that are loaded up on spike protein, they package it up into exosomes and they ship it out because they've got so much of it. You know, they can't get rid of it fast enough, so they have to just ship it out and throw it out into the circulation. And it's going to go all over the body, and including going into the lungs and getting released into the air. These exosomes that are packaged up with spike protein inside them. And the spike protein, of course, is very toxic. It's toxic everywhere it goes. And it goes up the vagus nerve and ends up in the brain. And then it starts causing neurological disorders. It goes along the nerve fibers and causes, you know, it causes prion diseases. This is something that we have a whole section of the paper talking about prion diseases, because the spike protein is a prion-like protein. And there have been papers written by others that have shown that this protein has a characteristic feature of a prion protein. And prion proteins are, for example, the source of mad cow. You've probably heard about mad cow in the cows in Great Britain. It's a devastating neurological disease. We have a human equivalent, which is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And that's due to the misfolding of prion proteins. But then there are many other neurodegenerative diseases that are linked to the misfolding of prion-like proteins, such as amyloid beta and alpha-synuclein. And tau. There's various proteins that are associated with Alzheimer's, ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's disease, And so all of these diseases, I think, are going to be going up because of the prion-like nature of the spike protein, because it's going to cause the other sensitive proteins to misfold in exactly the same way. The spike protein misfolds as a prion, and it's like seeds of crystal, and the crystal grows in the neurons to support neurodegenerative diseases. This is something that has me very, very worried, because I think, and I don't know how long it will take, it could take years or even decades. You know, people who could have gotten Parkinson's at the age of 70 will now get it at the age of 60, this kind of thing. We won't know for many, many years, and we won't associate it. And they're going to try very hard not to link it up, because they don't want us to believe that these vaccines have any risk. So, you know, so I think there's a whole bunch of diseases that are going to go up. We are already, you know, quite sick in this country, as you pointed out, and we're going to become even sicker because of these vaccines. The thing is that antibodies are not the best solution to the problem of a disease. And what you really want to be doing is focusing on strengthening your innate immune system by being healthy, rather than bombarding your body with these antibodies, because the antibodies also, of course, have the potential to become autoantibodies. And that's another whole section of our paper, that the antibodies, when you produce so many antibodies, they can become rogue antibodies that end up attacking your own tissues. And there are specific tissues, there are specific proteins, human proteins, that have similarities with the spike protein. The spike protein has many parts that are similar to pieces of human proteins that are associated with autoimmune diseases. And that's things like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis, celiac disease, all of those, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, all of those autoimmune diseases are going to become more prevalent, I believe, because of this force feeding our population with these injections.
Yeah, I was a part of a Zoom call today. There were about 100 doctors from around the world, and that was one of the topics, was a prion-like disease. And many of the doctors were already reporting case reports of patients with significant cognitive decline in their mental facilities pretty quickly after the vaccine, some within 2 weeks even. And so there's a growing concern amongst these practitioners that are noticing these side effects. And I think...
Yeah, in fact, Klassen is the one who wrote the first prion article that caused us to look into the prion possibility. And he's just published a new paper showing Parkinson's disease, really tremendous, and especially the DNA vector vaccines, which I haven't studied as much, they're causing very strong signal for Parkinson's disease, which is shocking because it's just even within a few weeks of the vaccine, whereas I would have expected it to take much, much longer.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate that people submitted to that spirit of fear and decided to make a decision. Be a part of this experimental emergency authorized gene therapy. However, if you have done that, I always point back to the amazing design of the body. So get back to the basics. And part of Dr. Sinha's book talks about it, Chapter 11, Reboot Today for a Healthy Tomorrow. And there's always hope by getting back to real food, sunshine, exercise, the basics that support that immune system function that Dr. Sinha is talking about. I just saw today, which today's July 21st, we're recording this, CDC came out and said there's 12,000 deaths. The whistleblower at the CDC says there's 45,000 deaths within 3 days of the vaccine. So there's an untold number of adverse events from this experimental therapy. And you know, a lot of the doctors on the call today are calling for an immediate halt to that, and they're trying to figure out a way to get their voice heard. And part of the way is producing this the kind of science that you're doing, Dr. Sinha. So thank you for all your work, for sounding the alarm over the past 10 years on glyphosate, and for connecting a lot of these dots through research and through your tireless efforts. So thank you for all you're doing for humanity. Really appreciate your book. It's a great book. I think probably the best book on glyphosate I've read. So Thank you for writing that. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right, everybody. You need to go to stephaniesineff.net to follow Dr. Seneff's work and stay in touch with what she's doing and check out her book for sure. I encourage everybody to go out and do that. Thank you all for listening today. It's always a pleasure of mine. Thank you again, Dr. Seneff. We really enjoyed it. We'll have to have you back. And everybody, come back next week. We'll have another great show, You're the Cure. Check out VeritasMedical.com for archive shows. VeritasMedical.com, under the resource section, you can see all those old shows. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.